I just want to welcome everybody. Thanks for coming in at lunch. I know how busy everyone is, but I can't think of a rarer moment in terms of inviting a speaker in. It was last minute because I didn't know until last Thursday that a wonderful friend had returned to Owen and to Nashville. And very, very excited that he could come in today and so many of you could join us. One of the neatest things about teaching here is every year we get the new students, we get to read resumes. And when we read the resumes, we get to see just how special every student is and the amazing experiences they've had and successes. And back in about 3 years ago, I was looking at resumes and I saw a resume of a young man named Ebenezer Ayi. And I read that his last job before coming to Owen was directing all transportation and logistics for the nation of Ghana, reporting to the president of Ghana. And then I realized there was a list of long, long experiences. Those experiences were involved in the military. He was a military officer in Ghana. And then I saw the term United Nations peacekeeping missions. And I read the Congo and many other hot spots. And then when I got down to 1994, I read the name Rwanda. And I remembered it having just seen the movie Hotel Rwanda, what had happened, and that's that a nation divided literally in half in hatred. And that a very, very angry group of Hutus decided to massacre all their brethren, Tutsis and moderate Hutus, who were peaceful, and they began to slaughter. The United Nations immediately sent in troops from throughout the world, including the United States. And then when things got completely out of hand, the United Nations ordered all their troops out because it was far too dangerous. And only one nation, Ghana, decided to stay. As I learned a bit more, I realized that people of Ghana throughout Africa are known as the people of peace and the people of goodness, and that they're known throughout history for always being willing to step in and help others who were in need of goodness or who were facing peril throughout all of Africa. And this was the case there. As I read the man's resume, I also saw the number 30,000. And then I read something about repatriating 30,000 people. So I asked my new friend, Evan, about that. And I realized that what had happened was on one particularly horrible day, they saw a mob chasing many, many thousand people. And so he and 102 of his men commandeered a soccer stadium. And they herded the 30,000 fleeing people into the soccer stadium and then locked the doors and gates. And then day after day and night after night, totally giving up all of their rations and all of their water to the civilians, they tried to stave off and did stave off an attack, a mortar attack, and a constant barrage of gunfire and rockets. And they saved the lives of 30,000 people. Every now and then you get to meet a hero. Every now and then we get to meet a hero. And it's particularly significant when that hero is a friend. Because I think what heroes tell us is the good that we all can do. Because everyone in the room has hero in them. So I'd like to introduce a hero. And that's my friend Evan. Are you? Come on up there.
I first want to thank Professor Talbot and the Owen Black Student Association for putting this together and then giving me the opportunity to share with you some of my experiences as well as my thoughts over the years working with the Ghana Armed Forces and the United Nations in our efforts at providing global peace and security. And to further, I want to say socioeconomic development worldwide. Secondly, I thank you also for the audience. Indeed, it's heartwarming to be here again after 2 long years, and I really miss the ambience in the Ebubush here. I'm of the view that as potential world leaders of both state and non-state actors in the international system, my thoughts that I will share with you will serve as a challenge to you wherever you may find yourself after Owen or wherever you're studying currently. In the facilitation of seeking global peace, security, and then socioeconomic development. Today, or let's say this afternoon, it is just an opportunity for us to discuss global peacekeeping in general, and then maybe focus to what is currently happening in Sudan and brackets the DAFO. So whatever it is, I just need to make a little statement. So I have just a note here, but maybe after 5 minutes, I'll just retire to my city, and then we will go into something we call maybe a discussion. People will have their comments, contributions, as well as ask me questions over my experiences that I've gone through over the years. As a young boy growing up in a very modest area called Accra in my native Ghana, I vowed that I'll have to arm myself with enough knowledge and experience in order to help alleviate the level of deprivation that I witnessed in my community. And I would say that I was given this opportunity when I was commissioned into the Ghanaian Forces in 1990, just after graduating from the University of Ghana. I've traveled to various harsh, public deprived environments, all in the name of peacekeeping. I've been to Lebanon, Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Liberia, the Congo, DRC, and lately I'm in Sudan. I wish to say that now I'm in the capacity of a civilian, I'm no more in uniform, but it's the same environment. During these tours, I've seen a lot of suffering. Yeah. I've lost very dear friends and men under my command. And like I always say, whenever I meet my friends and people who know me very well, I say, I'm a living library of the consequences of conflict. In Liberia, rebels cast lots over the determination of what sex is the unborn child carried by a pregnant woman. Rebels slit open the belly of the pregnant woman to determine the sex of the unborn child, and through that, decide the winner of their contest. Displaced persons cook grass and water and drank the resultant broth as food for the day. Children were not spared either. Instead of being in school, they were deployed as soldiers and sometimes as sex slaves. And I bet you the child soldiers were the most murderous. In Rwanda, I witnessed the slaughter of people of Tutsi extraction as well as moderate Hutus. The most surprising thing to me during my tour in Rwanda was that these people who were slaughtered went to their deaths with no protestation. The crisis situation presented by 3,000 internally displaced persons taking refuge in the Amahoro Stadium. That stadium still exists and is one of the biggest stadiums in Rwanda now. The crisis presented by this situation was really overwhelming. Ironically, the name of the stadium, Amahoro, translated in English means peace. But the people in that stadium never saw peace for over a month. There was no peace because whilst they were in the stadium, we were providing logistics for support. There was a lot of artillery shelling, bombings throughout the day, throughout the night. The crisis had to be managed through the Ghanaian contingent of about 102 men, as was said by Prof. Talbot. And we decided to stay after all other nationalities had been withdrawn by the United Nations. Ghana decided to stay. This was done, I would say, in complete disregard to the safety and security of our own men. But as military men were there, we had a mission, and the mission had to be completed. By the time the international community appropriately responded to the crisis, close to 1 million innocent Rwandans had been slaughtered. The international community was, however, present to count their dead and do the statistical analysis, something that they are very good at. Who is to blame in this situation? We are all parties to this global degeneration. In Sierra Leone, amputations of the limbs of not only combatants, but those of babies barely a year old. The damage from the to the socioeconomic fiber of the Sierra Leone society was indescribable. Nearly two decades of fighting in Sudan has left the society so deprived that the people of Southern Sudan and the Darfur today cannot be counted amongst normal societies. Challenge to seek maybe further knowledge, as I promised myself when I was a boy, towards attainment of my child's dream. I enrolled in Owen in the fall of 2005. At the end of the first year, I had opportunity once again when I was recalled by the United Nations, this time not in the capacity of a military guy, but in the capacity of a civilian, to help in the management of logistic support in various peacekeeping operations. I was initially deployed to the Sierra Leone, and currently I'm deployed in Sudan. I'm still looking at opportunity to come back to Owen, because I love Owen so much, and I believe that I should be part of the distinguished alumni of Owen. And maybe come this fall, I'll be back to continue with my studies. My humble message as I narrate this experience to you is that we could pass on to what I can pass on to you is that crises do not only evolve in our boardrooms or on the factory floors. The deprived communities in the conflict areas and other developing countries have more challenging crises that seek the attention of experienced and then knowledgeable minds, as you and I have today. Their type of crisis threatens the very foundation of human existence. Genocide, hunger, and disease prevail in these communities. The situation in Darfur is a very typical example of what is happening today. And until we are able to utilize our acquired knowledge in whatever sphere we study in today, and facilitate in bringing about a fair balance in the global socioeconomic system, this crisis will never end. And once this crisis don't end, there will be no peace and security anywhere in the world, because once it's happening here, people will move to the other side. If there's pressure on your economy, you also feel the pain. So we need to use whatever knowledge we have acquired, or whatever study we're doing, in trying to resolve crises in other areas, more so in very, very deprived and conflict areas. I believe that I'll be able to awaken your conscience with this narration. I don't intend it to be a speech, but it's just going to be a discussion, but just to maybe set the agenda and let the discussion flow. I decided to give you this narration. And I believe at the end of it all, once you are finished whatever studies you are doing, with your knowledge that you acquired, you can help in the facilitation to bring global peace, security, and then socioeconomic development globally. I think I'll pause at this juncture. I'm sure a lot of people are very interested in what is happening in the Sudan and the Darfur currently, but you should not have to hold yourself to only that area. There are a lot of things happening globally now, because there's a lot of conflict in the world. The UN now has over $6 billion procurement that they're doing because of an increase in global peacekeeping. So there are a lot of things happening, and then a lot of people are not very much interested because maybe they are not feeling the pinch now. But we need to have much knowledge so we can be informed in the decision that we take, both in contributions as well as helping during the crisis. I thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be looking for questions, contributions, and then comments. Thank you very much.
Any questions at all? I can start with one quick question. Yeah. Last Friday, you said, relax or wear, do whatever you like. It's your floor. You were speaking to the EMBA class on Friday, and you mentioned how you negotiate when you walk into a war-torn and ravaged area, and there's this opposing side and this opposing side. How do you negotiate? How do you institute negotiation? How do you bring them together?
Like I said at that time, I mean, in trying to negotiate, you really need to win the confidence of the two sides, whether it's conflict or whatever situation you find yourself. And winning the confidence, you need to show impartiality. You have to know that you are neutral. You don't have to create a situation where one party believes that, I mean, you're on the side of the other party. We used to have situations where we organize parties for, like, Christmas and other things for the two parties, and then invite all of them to our compound. And once they see that the other side is there and they are also there, they start building their confidence. And once they know that you are not only invited to one side, that confidence is built, and then they will come to you with any problem that you have. So the first thing is to win their confidence and then to show impartiality.
How do you stay impartial when you're looking at, like, the atrocities in Sudan, like one group killing another group, but how do you sort of keep your feelings out of that negotiation?
So, what is happening currently in the Darfur, for example, where we are able to establish that it is one side that is actually committing these atrocities, we'll have to let them know that the international community is well aware of whatever atrocities they are committing. In trying to win them to come to the negotiating table, you must let them know that you have the wherewithal and the clout to be able to, at a particular time, stop whatever they are doing. Once they know that you have the strength and resources, they will come to the table. Secondly, before a peacekeeping force is set into an area, it will have to be agreed by the two sides. If the two sides don't agree, then it's not a peacekeeping force. Maybe it's going to be an insertion where we have to now send a peace enforcement force into the area. That is what we are trying to do now in the Darfur. If we are not able to win the support of the Sudanese government and allow us to come in, then when we assess the situation, we realize that it's becoming alarming, then we have to go in using force. That is where we enforce the peace. But like you say, once there's a peacekeeping force, it means the two sides have agreed that we should come and monitor maybe their ceasefire. And once they have agreed that we should monitor their ceasefire, then we have to show impartiality. Yeah. But if they have not agreed, then we have to come in by force. And if we know it's this side that is actually causing the trouble, we have to use all our resources against them and make sure that they don't commit those atrocities anymore.
How did that 102 force, Ghanaian force, manage to stay off the folks that were trying to get to 30,000 people in the stadium? I mean, 102 people, I'm sure you could have been overwhelmed if that had been a frontal attack.
Well, like I said, that feat was really achieved not because we had the numbers or maybe the resources to be able to do that, but we realized that there was nothing to do. We couldn't also leave the people to perish. And so, I mean, using our military knowledge, I mean, providing security in an enclosed area like the stadium, there are certain things that we have to put in place to ensure that we don't have any shock entrance from those who were actually causing the atrocity. So we placed troops at various vantage points. And we have to build our shelters and other things to protect. So wherever we concentrate the refugees, we make sure we build shelters for them against these artillery shells. So we had equipment to be able to build those things. And although they were inside the stadium, they were not just spread all over the place. We kept them in areas where they could be protected from the artillery. But as to the people entering the stadium, we were at the gates to ensure that they will not do that.
How does the average person in the United States help with the situation in Darfur?
How they can help or how they can help? One thing that I know that is that many people in the United States are not very much informed. Maybe, okay, people are so much concerned with their day-to-day activity that they are not so much informed as
as to what is happening in Darfur now. But the United States government at a level is involved in what is happening in Darfur. I know that we have the USAID, United States Agency for International Development. I think the US government is seeking over $25 million a year into the Darfur to make sure that humanitarian assistance is taken to the right people there. And then at the United Nations level, US is pushing for a hybrid force, a force to, you know, currently it's the African Union force that is keeping peace in the Darfur, whilst the United Nations is in the south. We don't have a mandate to operate in the Darfur. The United Nations is pushing the Security Council to allow a peacekeeping force from the United Nations to be able to go in there to help the African Union to keep the peace, at least to allow humanitarian assistance into the area for the people, the displaced people, to have relief, at least food and other shelter and other things like that. So I know that they are pushing a lot. There are other organizations. I know International Relief Committee, IRC, South America. They are also inside in Darfur. Yeah, there are other organizations from other countries. Yeah, but at the American level, this is what I
do. I have two questions. They're kind of related to each other. Why did you decide to come to business school, and do you see any ties between your business studies and what you're doing right now? And my second question is, do you see a role for multinational corporations operating in those countries, and what can they do to help resolve some of the conflicts or help at least alleviate some of the situation there?
Yeah, for the first question, My initial aim for coming to business school was actually to get more into operations management, because most of as I developed in my career, I was more engaged in logistics support. And I know operations management, as a military officer, if you are to head any organization, you need to know a lot of management, leadership, negotiations, a lot of things. The package here is very, very relevant if you have been working for the United Nations, not to talk about working for the military. And currently, I handle over the two contracts, fuel contract, that's petroleum products contract, is over $360 million. And then the rations food contract is over $290 million. And you need a lot of management skills to be able to manage this kind of contracts. So it was my intention to get into logistics. And I know that the package here, the courses here, can actually prepare me for this kind of job. And then secondly, I cannot say that now in Sudan, I mean, multinationals have a much role to play. But when there is peace, Sudan currently has hit a lot of oil. They need multinationals to drill this oil. And then to build the socioeconomic fiber of the society, we need to bring in a lot of international foreign direct investment into the area. And multinationals can come in, invest, give jobs to the deprived people. So when there's peace, I know they have a lot of roles to play. But currently, because the place is tough, there's conflict, people are not much enthused to come there. But when they speak, I believe that they have much role to play there.
Some people are calling for Africa to play a greater role in peacekeeping, or for China to play a greater role in peacekeeping in Africa. Do you think China has a responsibility or a role there?
Yeah, I think all nations have roles to play in any conflict area. China, for example, is an emerging superpower. They have a lot of resources. I'm not blaming anybody, but most of the Western world have a lot of conditions before they come into your country to invest. When you go to Sudan right now, China is doing a lot of wonderful things there. Although sometimes they support the Sudanese government in trying to what whatever efforts the United Nations is making, because if we all agree that they should impose sanctions on Sudan, China, because of their economic interests, will still carry, go on with whatever investments they have there. But I think we need to have a continuous engagement with China to understand that it is not only, they should not seek only their economic interests, but they have to seek the interests of the people in Sudan as well. Because variously, if they don't help the international community to seek peace in the Sudan, the conflict can erupt and becomes worse. Then their investments there could be in jeopardy. So they are doing a lot of things there now, but most of the time, because of the economic interest in the Sudan, they close their eyes to a lot of things that the international community is calling for. For example, to put a lot of pressure on Sudan to allow peacekeeping forces to go into the Darfur. I know China is not helping the Security Council to get that resolution going, but I believe that we need to have continuous engagement with China for them to understand that we need them as much as they need the international community.
I just need your view on the United States troops in Iraq. What do you think about it? Do you think it's spending too much time over there, or do you think they should go there?
My current opinion now is that it's time for America to get out now. I mean, as a military guy, having studied mission analysis, you go into an operation with a mission, and then to succeed, you have to maintain that selected mission. What was the mission? The mission was to oust Saddam Hussein. That thing has been done, and I think they have stayed too long there. They have to move out, because unless they change the mission. But I think that it is time to move on. Yeah.
You talked a little bit about the investments of China, particularly in Sudan. What do you make, or like, what is your opinion of kind of the divestment campaigns that we see across the United States and on some university campuses that are aimed at multinationals that are directly involved with the government of Sudan?
You know, multinationals are in for their profits. That sometimes, ethically, we will say that that is not good. But somebody wants to say, there are people who need jobs in Sudan right now. So if there are multinationals who want to give them jobs, why not? But at the same time, we believe that the Sudanese government is not doing enough to ensure that the entire Sudan is free, they are liberated, and they are having a fair share of whatever booty, as I might call it, from the oil that they are exploring now. But there are certain multinationals, they don't care about this perception of the international community. They only want to make their profit. So I believe that it is good that people will have to advocate for pressure against most of these multinationals who are going contrary to the wishes of the international community. And then maybe we'll have to bring up sanctions against them. Maybe we cease doing business with those multinationals who are still going to Sudan without the permission of the United Nations or the international community, as we say. So I encourage people actually coming up, making noise about multinationals who are doing business with, let's say, rogue states, for example, in Sudan.
Have you ever been to any regions where you think that there is no hope, that despite all the peacekeeping efforts that these multinationals or whoever, that the greed, I guess, is going to prevail?
I see it again. Can you please speak up?
Have you ever seen any regions, like any of the places that you've been, that it's sort of a lost cause? Like, you may do this peacekeeping effort, but in the short term it may work, but in the long term the greed is ultimately going to prevail.
Yeah, for example, Liberia now. Liberia. I was in Liberia, I had 3 tours in Liberia in 1992, 93, and then 96. In 96, we had elections when we put a government in place. By 2001, the situation had gone worse. All the lives lost, the resources wasted. We went back to the same situation as in the beginning. Now, after that was even a sub-regional effort that was done by the West African Economic Force. And then the United Nations are currently there trying to solve the same problem that we tried to solve about a decade earlier. So I believe that when we try to sue for the peace and we are able to attain a peace, we have to be able to maintain the peace. Most often after a short while, we withdraw. We say, okay, everything's okay, so let us withdraw. But now the United Nations has another concept that is to maintain a follow-up in the area of conflict. In Sierra Leone, for example, the major force is out. We have a United Nations integrated office in Sierra Leone. We're going to have that office there forever. Yes, so that in the event that is anything erupting, we will have, let's say, a beachhead upon which to grow and then expand. Yeah. So it has started with Sierra Leone. I think Burundi, we also have a follow-up in Burundi. We have the same thing in Sudan. We've tried to build a big edifice in Sudan, showing that we are always present. We have the intention to stay there, even if we attain the peace, to maintain it and make sure that it goes to the end. Yeah.
Can you just elaborate on the current situation in Sudan itself? Is there a government? Is it recognized by the international community? And who are these rebels? And also, secondly, is there like a timeline that the international community sees in trying to put, to have a peaceful Sudan government? Is there like a timeline, or we just, just going to be never-ending project or something?
Okay, I think to answer this question, I have to give you maybe a small update or a description of the events as they are unfolded into Sudan. The Sudan is the biggest country in Africa. Yeah, it's almost the whole west of Western Europe. And then in the north of Sudan, we have the Arabs. They are light skinned. And then in the south of Sudan, we have the Africans. Now, the Arabs is believed migrated to the area. So now, they were initially colonized by Britain, by Egypt. And in the event of withdrawing, they gave power over to the Arabs. So these Arabs have lorded it over the blacks for a very long time. They are predominantly Muslims, and they want the whole of Sudan to be Muslim and then to come under Sharia law. And then you know what Sharia law entails. Okay, the blacks are atheists, some of them are Christians, and they don't want to come under Sharia law. So they've been fighting the Arabs up north for the past 2 decades or so. Currently, Sudan has been able to hit some oil, and they need to explore their oil. They don't have the resources to do that. They need international multinationals to come and do this. And the blacks, knowing that that is the power base of the Arabs, keep hitting or attacking the oil bases. So what would the Arabs do? To go see for peace, so that we peace for the multinationals to drill the oil. So now we have what we call the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. The United Nations and international community have been able to arrange some peace deal between the Arab North and the Black South. And up to 2011, there will be a referendum for the South to decide whether they would like to join the Arab for a bigger Sudan, or whether they would like to have a Southern Sudan. So until 2011, there is this joint government. The Arabs have the leadership, and then we have the blacks also including the vice leadership. So 2011, we'll have the referendum. After that, if they decide that they want to secede, they will have two Sudans, the Northern Sudan and the Southern Sudan. If they decide that they want to join the North for a bigger Sudan, that will also mean another thing. We have to go in for another mandate to ensure that, okay, now peace is spread throughout the Sudan. So we looked at 2011. What happens after the referendum will inform what decision to take for that. So we have the milestones, the steps, but the first one will be after 2011.
Which part of the country do you find the OMP?
Right, it's just along the middle belt of Sudan. And currently, there's a big fight because they know they anticipate that the South will secede. They're trying to withdraw the boundaries to make sure that the oil flows are in the north. So there's a district called Abyei. They're fighting along that place in order to say, okay, how do we draw the line? So there's a committee that is trying to see, make sure that they don't change the boundaries as they exist now. But there's a conflict over it.
So I mean, obviously, there's going to have to be some kind of revenue sharing. If you make there's still secession, there's going to have to be some kind of revenue sharing. Because from what you're saying, the North, the government that controls the revenue, is there anything in place right now or in the works that allows the South?
Yeah, there's something in the comprehensive peace agreement. There are clauses that allow for fair distribution of the wealth, the oil. Yeah, but as to whether it is being done well, because all we see is that the capital is being developed at a very fast rate, meanwhile the south areas are really behind. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on how Rwanda regrouped after the genocide? How stable do you think the country is now? And what do you think is going to happen once the Darfur region kind of calms down? Do you think it's going to be kind of similar to what happened in Rwanda?
There's a seemingly stability in Rwanda now. I visited Rwanda, that was last year, June. And there's some kind of peace, but I don't think the Hutus who actually committed those atrocities. I'm sure the Tutsis in an effort to make sure that everything is held very firm have also put themselves in a lot of these strategic areas, and then they are not allowing the Hutus to have much say in what is happening. So once, I think for some time, because there's this very firm hand as exhibited by their leader now, Kagame. If Kagame is no more, what happens? That is the fear. But now, as far as Kagame, who is a strong leader, is alive, I'm sure they will have this peace. But if Kagame is no more, I'm seeing the Hutus also striving for more say in whatever, in leadership. And now I can see something erupting there. Yeah.
You were saying earlier that we don't need to focus just on Darfur because there are other areas around the world that are also in conflict or may go into conflict. And I was just wondering, what areas do you think we need to keep our eyes on, or and what kind of preventative measures can we take to ensure that the conflict stays down?
Currently, I mean, the United Nations has a situation where we keep a watch over areas that we think are potential conflict areas. The potential conflict areas that I'm aware of now are Chad, Somalia, the Central African Republic. These are areas that we think that there's potentiality of conflict erupting anywhere from now. So, but what happened in your second question as to what we can do, I believe that there's a lot of unfairness in the general socioeconomic system. There is an imbalance. And once people always feel deprived, it is very easy to get people to go into rebellion when they feel that things are not favoring them. So all we have to do is to build an enabling environment for these people to feel that there are other options apart from getting into rebellion. So we have to push more aid, not only aid. How do we build the structures, more infrastructure, getting foreign direct investment into the area and build up a lot of structures that could support continuous economic development. So once we are able to, if people are conscious of these potential problems, and they invest into these areas, they will come to the realization that it is not necessary to always go into rebellion, because you have other options to develop yourself. If you are able to develop yourself, you don't just cartel to anybody who says, let's go into rebellion, let's go into fight, because because you have other things to protect, like you have a property or an investment to protect. You don't easily go into a rebellion. But once people don't have anything to do, it is easy to come and say, okay, look at what is happening to you. Let us rebel against this government. So I think the developed world will have to do more by providing this enabling environment, providing direct investment into these areas that we see as potential areas. And then once the economy is good, I don't think you're going to rebel.
Building on that, how do you suggest working with governments to fight corruption or different things that would drive investment away from countries like that?
Corruption. It all boils down to the same deprivation. Because I'm from Ghana, that is probably an African country. People always feel that they don't have enough. And the only means, I don't think that it's enough justification to go into corruption. But once there is scarcity and there is a need to go for more, people will find other ways. And then so we have to build those economies. We have to help them to come up. And once people have a lot of investment and a lot of things to hold on to, they will not think much more about corruption. Sometimes too, it's leadership. We have problems with leadership now. That's why I'm saying that. We're having more Africans, more people from the developed world coming to see what is happening in the developed world. People having education, they go back, they can use their acquired knowledge to push more against this kind of corrupt activities. Yeah. So giving people more scholarship, giving a level, putting more direct investment into those areas, and then enabling them to be able to rise up to other opportunities. I think those are the things that will help these areas to go move a bit away from corruption.
Your particular function as a contract manager, are you able to tie in, let's say if you sign a contract with a multinational, tie in that contract with something else that you can do within the country to help the situation? Or is it just strictly for them to provide whatever service you were contracted for?
Firstly, we believe that by bringing that contractor into that locality, the contract provides jobs. People now come and they bring their expertise from an international arena. They impart that expertise. The people come to know a lot of things by this multinational coming to the company. Indeed, there are other things that the UN is proposing now. For example, things against sexual exploitation. So before a contractor comes in, we have weather clauses to show them, to tell you that you don't have to get involved in this. Environmental degradation, there are clauses to make sure that these things don't happen. But the first thing is providing jobs and then providing expertise to the local population.
It's about that time. Any last minute advice? We've got to say the class in about 5 minutes, so any? Oh, you guys have any questions?
Yeah.
How much language does do you speak?
Six. I'm not. I speak English. I can communicate in English, French. Yeah, not as English. Then once you are on peacekeeping somewhere, you must be able to learn some language to be able to move around. And I can pick some few dialects in Arabic now because I'm in Sudan. So to say good morning, I want to go here. Those kind of things. But the other three languages are languages from my country, Ghana.
So any last minute advice?
So like I said, when I started, I believe that the African continent is weeping blood. Not only Africa, there are a lot of developing areas that really need the knowledge and expertise of people of able minds like you and me, so that we will not only be thinking about going to the corporate boardrooms or maybe the factory floors, But there's a whole lot of crisis happening in other areas now. And this crisis, like I said, I mean, challenges the very foundation of human existence. If we leave it as it is now, very soon we shall also be feeling the pinch. So let us, in our small way, try to enable these localities or these environments by providing leadership, good management, and then the resources for them to be able to realize there are other options than to go into conflict. When we do that, I believe that very soon we'll have global peace, spirit, and then socioeconomic development. Thank you very much.